This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. We'll start today's pod with the devastating news from the Africa Cup of Nations. Dozen injured and at least eight people reported to be dead after a crush outside the Elembe Stadium in Yaoundé, where the hosts were playing Comoros. As we've said on this pod before, no one should go to a football match and not return. We'll speak to Nick Ames, who's in Cameroon for The Guardian. Again, the actual football pales into insignificance, but we'll cover Watford, Ranieri out, Roy Hodgson's possible return. We'll focus on the EFL, Fulham's extraordinary scoring run, Blackburn's rise and the latest goings on with Derby and Birmingham. We'll update you on Leagues 1 and 2 if you don't normally check that far down. And Susie Rack will join us to talk WSL, controversy in the Arsenal City game and Chelsea held by Brighton. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Okay, let's start with the tragic news from the Elembe Stadium in Yaoundé, the capital of Cameroon, at the host nation's African Cup of Nations match with Comoros. The news only came about a while after the game itself. Nick Ames is in Cameroon, wasn't at the stadium yesterday. Nick, thanks so much for coming on.
No problem at all, Max.
It's worth saying you're a long way from the stadium. The nature of news these days means you probably don't know a huge amount more than we do, but what is the latest that you have?
Yeah, I'm about 5 hours away in a city called Bafoussam, although I'm going to be returning to Yaoundé fairly shortly. And it's also worth pointing out that the media who were actually inside the stadium last night had no idea that any of this was going on. What happened was, as far as we know, there was a crush of supporters attempting to enter the match between Cameroon and Comoros, I think at the south entrance of the stadium. Not quite sure whether this happened maybe around kickoff, but the timing is a bit unclear. And tragically, the Cameroonian government, I think this morning, have confirmed that there were 38 injuries, seven of them were serious, and also eight people died is the number at the moment. We were certainly receiving reports to that effect last night, and they appear to tragically be the case. So obviously an absolutely shocking incident, something that you'd never expect to see at any kind of major football tournament. And I think there'll be a lot of grieving, obviously, here in Cameroon, but there'll be a lot of questions asked as well about how this could happen and what happens next in this tournament and a venue that's still got a lot of big games to host.
It's always dangerous to speculate in times like this, but there were concerns about the state of this stadium before the tournament started, weren't there?
There were concerns. I think it was there was a big race against the clock to get various aspects of it ready, certainly around the exterior. Whether that extended to access, I don't completely know, but we'll be endeavouring to find out. But there was definitely a worry about whether Elembe was going to be ready to host the tournament. I think it was only past fit a few weeks before. I guess details will come out about exactly what happened around the stadium in entrance last night. One person I've spoken to who has got knowledge of the stadium and has covered several games there has suggested to me that the number of entrances at that side of the stadium is not very many and maybe very small and may have been susceptible to a lot of people trying to come in, but that's just what one person has suggested to me. And it's also worth pointing out that the stadium was only 80% capacity for this tournament. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Cameroon games are capped at 80%. So people will be wanting to know whether there was any danger of that capacity being exceeded on the night. But again, it's very hard to say too much at the moment without speculating. The only sad facts we know are about the injuries and the eight tragic deaths.
And it really just, look, it's trite to say and it seems so obvious, but just put such a darker mood on the tournament after a game. You say all the journalists who were there had watched this extraordinary game of football with so many stories going through it, and that will all be lost because of the far more important and far more tragic news that we've heard that I'm sure, you know, the journalists that you're with at the moment and the people you're with at the moment are discussing instead.
Yeah, it was, you know, quite a carnival atmosphere, certainly here in Bafoussam last night. I think it is whenever Cameroon are playing, the bars outside are over spilling onto the street every time. Well, both times Cameroon scored, you could hear the whole city go up, basically. And now the next morning, just looking around, I think there's a lot of conversations about how this has happened at an event when Cameroon is showing itself to the world like this. And what happens next? And Cameroon, if they win their quarterfinal against Gambia, are due to be back there for the semi-final, and which seems quite a likely prospect. And then obviously maybe onwards to the final. Now, those are massive games. So what happens? Do they start to look at alternative venues? Do they beef up the security? Almost feels a bit tasteless to wonder about that when obviously there have been so many tragic deaths and injuries at this point. But it's going to, I think, however we end up now, it's going to cast a significant shadow over the tournament, sadly, which is a massive shame. And I think our thoughts are with everybody who's been involved today. It's a tragic state of affairs.
Yeah, completely echo that. Nick, thanks so much for coming on, mate. And sorry to get you on such somber circumstances.
No problem at all, Matt. Speak soon.
Nick Ames, who's out in Cameroon, will be back in Cameroon for Thursday's pods. And we'll be back in a second. I'll bring on the rest of the panel and we'll talk about the rest of the football, trite as it may seem. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So on the panel for the whole pod today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Ben Fisher, hello.
Hi, Max.
And Sammy James. Some listeners will know him as Producer Sammy, also host of the Fulhamish podcast, a pod debut, stepping up from, you know, the backroom staff to, you know, the on-air talent, Sammy. In a way, what this is like... Well, this is like Jason Tindall playing for Newcastle, isn't it? This is what's happening now. It's a huge moment for all the producers of the pod, past and present, and for yourself. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Mel Rudd was the first person to do it. I saw her footsteps several years ago, and I just knew that I could emulate her one day.
And now here you are. Let's start, before we do the EFL, with Watford. Charlie says, at this point, what was least surprising to hear? Revelations of another lockdown party by Boris, or that Watford have sacked their managers? Ben says, how many Watford managers will come and go during this podcast? So Watford have sacked Claudio Ranieri. Not really a surprise. Less than 4 months after giving him the job. He was appointed after the sacking of Cisco Munoz in October. He's picked up 7 points during 13 league games in charge, winning only two games. Sacked after that terrible defeat at home to Norwich. The Hornets board recognises Claudio as a man of great integrity and honour, the club said, who will always be respected here at Vicarage Road for his efforts in leading the team with dignity. Barry, your reaction?
I'm not surprised they sacked him because the job he was doing wasn't good enough. I'm kind of surprised they hired him in the first place because I didn't see him as a firefighter or a man to get them out of the pickle they found themselves. And I also was a bit surprised, well, not by the timing, but I think he's brought in at least four, if not more, players in the current window already, which, now, I don't know how much input he had personally on those signings, but again, it seems odd to bring in a number of players like that. Presumably he had some say in the matter and then get rid of him. And I'm surprised it took them as long as it did to announce that they were firing, because I thought he'd go, you know, that announcement would be made on Saturday evening or Sunday, some point on Sunday. And now I see that Roy Hodgson is being linked with coming out of retirement and taking over there. Whether or not that would be a good appointment, I have no idea. But Watford are a mess, and the performance against Norwich on Friday night was absolutely abysmal.
Sammy, you saw Ranieri do something pretty similar at Fulham. I mean, have you just watched this Watford debacle and just seen every step, one step ahead?
I promised myself when I came on the pod I wouldn't crowbar Fulham into everything. But then again, it's Claudio Ranieri and they want to appoint Roy Hodgson.
I know,
so I feel
perfect.
Like I can't avoid it.
It's the ultimate booking. Yeah.
Claudio's time at Watford was so similar in terms of results of what he did at Fulham. Started off with a couple of wins. He won his first game at Fulham. Obviously at Watford, he won the game against Man United and also that amazing win at Everton. And then both times he ended with a run of 7 defeats in 8 and then got sacked after that 7th defeat. I saw at Fulham that he isn't, as Barry says, a firefighter. I thought it was a bit of a weird recruitment strategy to bring in Claudio. He's got no real reputation as someone who goes in and saves clubs, an Allardyce, etc. He seems to just kind of hope that he'll fix the defence, but he doesn't often seem to do that too well. He definitely didn't in his time as Fulham, and the defence got even worse. And I just think that it was a matter of time, really. The defeats were just stacking up, and with the way that Watford sack managers left, right and centre, I think this was probably the least surprising sacking of the season, really. I just hope that Norwich win every game from now on, and then every team loses their manager from here on in, because if you lose to Norwich, it's now an automatic sacking. So I'm hoping that Norwich go on and win every game between now and the end of the season.
I wonder with Ranieri, he's such a nice man. Reminds me that when I got here, I bought a Ford Focus off a really nice used car dealer. He's an old man. Actually, I didn't meet him, my wife did. But the car's absolute shite. The radiator's broken, the aircon's gone. But because he's so nice, you can't complain. You can't even write a bad review. Then it transpires my brother-in-law also bought a shit car off the same nice old man. But it's like, I'm not saying Ranieri's a con man. He won the title. But now it appears that he gets jobs because he's a lovely man. He's probably getting millions of pounds as well for just losing 7 in a row. I mean, Ben, were they too hasty in sacking Cisco Munoz? And I confess I had to Google who was the previous Watford manager. I thought it might have been Jukanovic. I knew it wasn't Sanchez Flores, but I was going with Jukanovic for sure. But Cisco did well in the Championship, and then they didn't really give him that much time, did they?
No, I mean, looking back, you could definitely make that argument. It's not really the Watford way, though, is it? I'm not sure. I was surprised he wasn't given any longer. I am a bit surprised that it seems like Roy Hodgson is the man that they want. And that feels almost too sensible for Watford, really. I was expecting somebody a bit more maybe exotic or left field, basically, which Hodgson is in some ways. I mean, I think he's 74 now. I thought he was done, certainly as a Premier League manager. I thought the closest we may see him to a Premier League game, if you like, was, I don't know, some sort of upstairs role. The thought of him back on the touchline with Ray Lewington in tow is pretty special. And I think, you know, he will organise, or he should organise a team, and he will make them, you would think, defensively harder to beat. But it's a very funny squad, quite a mishmash of players there. It's very Watford, and I'm not sure if I even fancy Roy Hodgson's sort of pragmatism to get them over the line, to be honest.
Hodgson's tactics take time, though. Hodgson has never been a quick go in there, rally the troops and get instant wins. Hodgson is methodical on the training ground. It's repetition, and that does take quite a long time to bed in. And have Watford got 2 months to wait until Hodgson's kind of training repetitive methods start making an impact? I don't think they do. I find it a baffling move, but mostly from Hodgson, as you say, at 74, like, surely he just wants to put his feet up now or become a director of football or just go on the odd Football Focus panel. I can't see at 70, he doesn't need the money, surely. Maybe he's just fed up of pottering around the house.
Listen to all this ageism from the young panelists, yeah. Barry. It's outrageous. Age is just a number, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting, mind you, the thought of 2 months of repetition with Roy Hodgson doesn't sound like the dream to me. You know, if I was the Watford back four, I'd be pretty disappointed.
Doesn't he come in and basically tie a rope around, you know, the back four so that everywhere they go, whether it's on the training pitch or in the canteen or on their way home, they all have to be side by side, attached by this, like little table football men with a bar going through them. It's probably worth pointing out, it being Watford we're talking about, that we're having this discussion very early on a Tuesday morning, and by the time this podcast is released into the wild, they may well have appointed somebody completely different.
It is true. Presumably, Sammy, you must love the man, though. I mean, for what he did
Oh yeah,
football club.
He's top tier. Maybe he is what John Beck is to you. Just he is the holy grail for Fulham. I'd love to see him come back and be some sort of director of football job at Fulham. I think all Fulham fans kind of hoped that one day he'd return as some wise sage man that would help us off the pitch and invite hospitality people into the lounge. But sadly, he seems that him and Ray in his shorts still want to manage random football teams. And so fair play to him. It's in his blood, isn't it? I think that's all that you can say for this, is that he just obviously loves football and wants to be out there. And yeah, age is not really a factor to him, but I am surprised.
Yeah, I did say, tweeted, it'd be nice to see Ray Lewington in the Watford shorts, but he actually did manage Watford back in the day. So there are already photos doing the round of Ray Lewington in those particular shorts, if that's what you're into. Let's talk about the Football League, shall we then? I'm very aware that a lot of fans will know all of this, but there will be quite a few listeners who are just looking for their quarterly update of who's where in the EFL. I know you are, Barry. You were complaining about having to get up early to watch the highlights, weren't you?
Yes, I was. it's Tuesday morning. I had to get out of bed at 5:30 a.m. I'm generally an early riser anyway, to watch EFL Quest with Colm Murray, Joby McEnough, and a friend of the show, George Ellick. A fine watch it was too, but not really my idea of a fun Tuesday early morning, pre-dawn.
Anyway, Fulham are top. Played 27, 5 points clear of Blackburn, who've played a game more. Bournemouth, 3 points further back, also played 27. QPR, West Brom, Huddersfield in the playoff spots. Barnsley at bottom. Same points, but not really, as Derby. And Peterborough also in the bottom three. Fulham extended their lead at the top with a 3-2 win at Stoke at the weekend. Sammy, they've scored 73 in 27 games. I mean, Jim says, are you concerned they may use up all their goals before the end of the season? That run before the Stoke game of beating Reading 7-0 and then Bristol City and Birmingham 6-2. For a football fan, it's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
We were getting desensitized to goals. Honestly, goals just went in. It was like, yay, it's the fifth one in the third game running. It was just nonsense, the amount that we were scoring. We came up against three good teams from Fulham's point of view that really didn't have all that much to fight for, or didn't seem to have, had problems elsewhere in the likes of Birmingham and Reading, etc. Maybe their focus wasn't on defending. But Fulham are, just sensational. It's, 73 goals. We're on course to score 125, if my percentages are correct. The second tier record is 109, which was Leicester in 56-57. So I think it's on track for Fulham to break that record. It's been very, very enjoyable. I think it's one thing to be on paper the best team in the league, which I do believe we are, but actually to go and walk the walk in such an impressive way is another thing. And the credit has to go to Marco Silva for managing to get the players motivated after another relegation and get them fighting again to do what they've done at the top. They've had a few blips this season, a few dodgy runs and a couple of bad results. Coventry away particularly was terrible back in October. We got spanked 4-1. But other than that, it's been a joyful season to be a Fulham fan. And you just wish that you could have these days forever where you go and win all these games. But we know that in 12 months' time, we'll be delighted because we've got our second win of the season against Crystal Palace at home. And it was an edgy 1-0 win. And you just know what's coming, which it makes it, I guess, it takes an edge off it. But right now, it's fantastic. And I just want to go to every game because Fulham are just fantastic at the moment.
Ben, are they Premier League good? Or do you sort of follow what Sammy says, that they'll just keep doing this? And who is playing particularly well for that? I saw Rodrigo Muniz, who is not someone I know a lot about, scoring what seemed to be about 1,000 goals when I was watching Fulham's last four game.
Yeah, I think it's 22 goals, is it, in the last four games, which is pretty absurd in itself. Obviously, we can't even talk Fulham without talking about Mitrovic, who was ill at the weekend, but 30 goals in 31 games for club and country this season, which is, phenomenal. I think he scored personally more goals than Hull, Derby and Peterborough for Fulham in the league. which is kind of probably a compliment to him, but also a bit of an indictment about those teams. But he obviously is the focal point. And like Sammy said, I do think actually that Marco Silva maybe deserves a bit more credit than he's getting or will get if Fulham do get over the line. Because I suppose his reputation was a little bit tarnished by how things happened at Everton and arguably Watford too. Obviously at Hull, he had that kind of, he developed this kind of sexy image almost overnight. He became very popular off, you know, not an awful long spell, I suppose, awfully long spell. But he's done really well, and particularly with Mitrovic, he has managed to make a player who last season in the Premier League was not on the periphery, but almost going that way, wasn't really happening for him. And he's totally revitalised him, got him back on song. He's been really impressive. I do really like Niskin's Cabano as well, who plays in sort of three behind Mitrovic usually. And but I mean, just take your pick really in terms of those forward players. I think, you know, Harry Wilson is superb at this level, really classy player. Fabio Cavaglio, a young player who I think the only fear with him is, Sammy might correct me if I'm wrong, but I think his contract is running out and Fulham might be in a tricky situation with him. But yeah, no shortage of attacking players. And like Sammy says, they are playing with style. They're not just picking up results.
Sammy, is it still Tim Ream just, you know, at the back? And so will they realise that doesn't always... I don't want to be anti-American. Or like, or do you think these players can, you know, they've got experience now. You know, I was watching the highlights going, oh, look, there's Tom Kearney. He's quite good, but is he Premier League quality? Anthony Robertson, I was quite liked on the left. But, you know, can those players step up?
I think the majority of them can. Look, Tim Ream's an interesting one. In the Championship, he is honestly Franz Beckenbauer. But the lack of pace in the Premier League does alarm me. He'd be 36 next year. Tim Ream was struggling for pace in the Premier League long before this, but that's a question for the summer. And I don't want to be anti-Ream because I love him to pieces, and he is a fantastic player, particularly at the Championship. And I would love to see him kind of in the squad next year. I do think most of the team can step up. I think that we were handed a really, really tough ask the last time we were in the Premier League because we only had 4 weeks between winning those playoffs and then the Premier League. We started abysmally because there was just no preparation time. Most of those players now have at least a year or two's experience in the Prem. And look, I'm not saying we're going to go up and finish eighth and start breaking records and smashing Chelsea 7-2, but I do think that we can come up and be competitive because I think that there's a lot of experience. I think that Marcus Silva is brilliant at the helm. It's just about keeping players' confidence. Mitrovic is such a confidence player, and I know most strikers are, but he is different level confidence. He scores a goal and he looks 2 foot taller. And sometimes I find that in the Premier League, he can go on a barren run of not scoring in 10 games because he's just not...
He's tiny then.
Yeah,
he really
yeah.
Tiny. He's like he scores a hat-trick.
Yeah.
He scores a hat-trick, he'll grow 6 foot. There's got to be a time when actually being too tall, it's too tall to be useful on the pitch.
You've got to put a cross as high as the stand in order for him to get his head on it. But that's my only worry, is that we're a bit streaky and maybe we'd come up to the Premier League and lose confidence. But I don't know, something Water says that if we do go up, that we will be more competitive. I'd still take 39 points in 17th, though, because given the roller coaster that Fulham have been on, and it's basically in 8 years, we've barely stayed in the same division. So it would be nice just to have a couple of years in the Premier League, a bit of stability. Let's be Crystal Palace. Let's be Crystal Palace for a few years. You know, 14th, I'll take it. I'd love it.
I was just going to ask Ben about Michael O'Neill at Stoke. Is he still popular with the fans there? They're sort of, I think, around 9th or 10th, still in with a chance of getting the playoffs. And oh, Max, you, how depressed were you to see DiMarzio Wright Phillips scoring for Stoke? Son of Sean, grandson of Ian, certainly made me feel old. I don't know about you.
It's very upsetting, isn't it? Grandchildren of your heroes. God, it's just... And I don't think I'm that young, but anyway, there we are. The question was not about how old I feel, and this is before I've had a baby. This is to Ben Fisher about Michael O'Neill.
Yeah, no, I think it's a hard one, Barry, really, because I think Stoke should be in that top six sort of package, if you like. Obviously, they're not there at the moment. They have had a couple of poor results. Obviously, they lost to Fulham on the weekend. I think there's an element of pressure, I think, on Michael Olunga to get them in the mix. I personally still fancy them, and they've strengthened again this month. But I think there's a little bit of frustration if it goes awry. I mean, it's so easy just to fall off the pace. We've seen it. I mean, Bournemouth, obviously, a little bit higher up, and West Brom to an extent as well. The pressure is on those bigger clubs, if you like, to make it happen.
What about Blackburn, Ben? I mean, I sort of feel ready for Rovers to be back in the Premier League. They went up to second after beating Middlesbrough last night.
Yeah, Tony Mowbray just doing a marvellous job. And normally very kind of mild-mannered, quite low-key. But last night at the final whistle, we saw a couple of kind of air punches. And, you know, he looked pretty on cloud nine. Even he, you know, a few smiles after the game in terms of when he was asked about, you know, can you do it? Can you be the sort of surprise package in terms of getting in the automatics? Last night as well, they did it without Ben Brereton-Diaz, who's on international duty. Sam Gallagher stepped up, really good finish. Just took the shot on the spin on the edge of the box. And I mean, Gallagher's quite a good story, really, without kind of going over old ground. When he was breaking through at Southampton, his dad died when he was 18, and it was obviously a really tough time. And then since then, I would argue it's been a bit of a slow-burning career, but he seems to have sort of found his feet again at Blackburn. He had a really good loan spell a couple of years ago, and yeah, great to see him get a really important goal. And they're right there. I mean, they're Fulham's nearest challengers now, with Bournemouth having a real wobble.
Middlesbrough have been on a pretty good run themselves, haven't they? Since Chris Wilder took over from Neil Warnock, picked up 20 points from 9 games, going from 15th to 7th in the Championship. Dale Fry said, the atmosphere around the place is absolutely fantastic. Everyone's buzzing. Everyone in the town is talking about promotion, which I suspect is overstating it slightly. I suspect there are some people in Middlesbrough not talking about it. I don't know if you've seen Middlesbrough play, Sammy, this season, but how are they looking?
I think they're looking fantastic. And until last night, my hot take was going to be that I think Middlesbrough could finish top two. I still think they could, but last night was a big blow for that. They'd have cut the gap to 5 points to the top two had they won at Blackburn last night. And to be honest, from what I saw of the game, I thought that Middlesbrough were the better team, and I thought we were unlucky not to at least come away with a point. They had some really good chances, a couple cleared off the line. They had one in the very, very final minute, which was put over the bar. They were had 100% record in the new year until last night. I think they're dead certs for the playoffs, Middlesbrough. Chris Wilder is such a good manager, and I think that's the bag of the season, getting Chris Wilder. I think that Premier League clubs, if you look at Watford right now, I think, honestly, Chris Wilder could have been a little bit of what they need to go in there. The fact that Middlesbrough kind of sought the opportunity, got rid of Neil Warnock, which was a bit controversial because he wasn't doing a terrible job, but they just saw the opportunity to upgrade with Chris Wilder. He's gone in there, revolutionised it. Yeah, Borough fans are really happy last night, happy at the moment. They took a huge crowd to Blackburn, and they seem really buoyed. And I think they believe definitely that they've got a chance of going up. If it's not via the automatics, I would back them massively in the playoffs if they get there.
Jason says, more of a quest. As Shota Avaladze is set to be appointed the new Hull manager, can Max say his name, I presume, in the style of Jim White? Shota Avaladze. It's almost as fun as Roland de Châtelet. You wanted to talk about Hull, Sammy, briefly, didn't you?
Yeah, they've obviously been bought recently by Ajun Ilıkali, who is the Turkish Simon Cowell. I could say he's Brilliant. The Turkish Max Rushton. He writes, he presents. He's a media mogul. He brought Survivor, Deal or No Deal, and Dancing with the Stars to Turkey, produced the shows and presented them, and now he's bought Hull City. And Hull fans are delighted because the Alam family are gone, and they've not been very popular. I don't think trying to change their name to Hull Tigers did them any favours back in the day. And it looks like, though, despite beating second place Blackburn and third place Bournemouth, that they're going to sack Grant McCann. It's not official yet, but it looks like it's on the cards, and they want to bring in Shota Avaladze, who has not exactly got the best managerial record. He's managed at Trabzonspor and Maccabi Tel Aviv, and his latest side was Paktakor Tashkent in the Uzbekistan Premier League. He did win the League and Cup, and I don't want to discredit the Uzbekistan League, of course, but not exactly, I would say, the same credentials as Grant McCann, who I think is a really good manager, will go on to get another job. But it seems to me that Hull fans are just happy to change ownership. And if the collateral damage is losing Grant McCann, that's fine. They're also interested in signing Ryan Babel, which I thought was a bit of a blast from the past at 35. I think it's actually quite a good signing. He was, again, sorry to crowbar it in, he was good for Fulham a couple of years ago in the Premier League, and I think he'll give a few Championship right-backs a bit of a torrid time because he's a very, very smart footballer despite losing the pace. So big changes at Hull. It's a bit of a gamble, but remains to be seen whether actually it could be. I don't want to rule it out because we've seen managers come in the past who seemingly have no experience and it's a new ownership making a crazy decision what it seems on the outset and then they actually do quite well. So I don't want to go in there and say it's all bad, but it seems like a risk to me.
The mention of Tashkent there calls to mind the great Jamaluddin Abdujaparov, one of my favourite cyclists, who was known as the Tashkent Terror.
I was wondering, Barry, would you get up pre-dawn to watch the Uzbek League or perhaps the highlights of the Uzbek League with Colin Murray?
I would get up at dawn to watch any number of Tour de France sprint finishes featuring Jamaluddin Abdujaparov. Go and have a look on YouTube if you've never heard of him.
Ben, can we talked a lot about Derby last week. Can we talk about Birmingham very briefly? Chris says, if you cover the Birmingham protests against the owners, please don't lazily say it's due to a lack of investment. As though we've not spent any money in recent seasons, we have, just dreadfully. Sam says, I'd love some coverage of our protests. Our ownership is opaque. Many fans and journalists aren't informed as to actually who owns the club and who's pulling the strings.
Yeah, it is very complex at Birmingham into exactly that. Who is pulling the strings? Who is behind it all? I think that's what the fans want answers on and clarity. It's a bit like Reading, I suppose, in that situation where it's very murky behind the scenes, which is no good for anybody. As you say, Birmingham spent a lot of money, seemingly not in the right places. The ground is falling down in places. They've released a couple of pictures of, you know, mass kind of corrosion in the steel kind of girders and stuff. And, you know, I think the lower halves of two of the stands are still closed to fans because of asbestos and just not being fit for purpose, basically. So that's, you know, no good. I feel a bit sorry for Lee Bowyer as the manager because there's all this going on around him. He's quite popular with the fans, obviously former player there. Left a pretty decent gig at Charlton to sort of walk into that mess. Craig Gardner is now the technical director, whose brother Gary is in the midfield. And, you know, and again, I think he's seen as sort of relatable to fans. But beyond Bowyer and Gardner, I think that's the problem. There's various people with control there, I suppose, that the fans are worried about and don't know enough about. As you say, there's some lots of fans have looked into it, but I don't think they like what they see. They're asking for more communication. And I saw that one of the directors, Edward Zeng, said at a meeting with fans recently, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but I think the words he said were, you know, it's our sort of way to act first and talk later. Well, I don't think that's appeasing the fans, that approach at the moment. As you say, there's a protest before the Barnsley win, which was massive because Birmingham was sliding. You know, a couple of green shoots. Joby Bellingham, Jude's younger brother, 16, is a regular fixture on the bench in the last couple of games, made his debut against Plymouth. But, you know, beyond that, it's quite gloomy, I would say, around St Andrews at the moment, and especially with the stadium in effect falling down. Birmingham Sports Holdings Limited, who own 75% of the club, are the company that the fans have their gripes with. They're Hong Kong based, but lots of people have their sort of fingers in that pie, if that makes sense.
It's interesting, actually, for just looking at Lee Bowyer. He, as far as I'm aware, he was very content in retirement, running a fishing lake or some sort of fishing resort somewhere in France, and now he's come into management. He's had a job at Charlton where the ownership was, you know, all over the shop and the fans were extremely disgruntled. Now he's at Birmingham in similar circumstances. He has yet to get a job in management where, you know, he's at a club that isn't completely dysfunctional and the fans aren't enraged. And I know Birmingham fans don't have any beef with him, but everywhere he's been so far, management has been really chaotic. he must be looking forward to, like, at some point in the future, getting a job at a, you know, a nice club, like, I don't know, Swansea or something.
Maybe it was a very dysfunctional fishing lake. You know, that's what he's used to. You know, he doesn't want the calm, serene fishing lake. He wants the jeopardy and the anguish.
Before we get on to League One and Two, Max, QPR, can they go straight up, do you reckon? And will Nottingham Forest hold on to Brennan Johnson in this window?
Oh, Barry, I'll start with the last one. Forest determined to keep Brennan Johnson. Personally, I'm unashamedly his biggest fan. I'd like to see him play a key part for Wales as well in March. He has been electric for Forest, scoring, assisting, just causing havoc. Defenders hate him. I think they'll keep him until the summer, but Brentford are very keen and they're among the teams looking at him. As opposed to QPR, they've got another winger sort of rolling back the years. Albert Adoma's come, who's a QPR fan. I think he said before he used to buy QPR shirts in the club shop when he was in non-league and the rest of it, and he's now doing the business for them. I think he's 33, 34. He also recently set a record of championship record appearances, but that is only in the championship, not the second tier, we think. But QPR going really well. I think they've got a couple of games in hand still, and they've got so much firepower, Barry. I think they could, I don't think they'll get into the top two, but I think they've got a hell of a chance through the playoffs.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do Leagues One and League Two quickly, and then Susie Rack will join us and we'll talk about the WSL. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. It says here, Ben Fisher's brand new feature, five exciting January EFL signings. Can you do it very quickly, Ben?
That sounds like one of the game shows that the Hull owner is probably fronting.
I'd watch.
I think you could. I'd love it, Ben, if you became an absolute superstar, the Anton Deck of Turkish television.
Do you think I could be big in Turkey?
I think you could be big in Turkey. Why not? I don't know what...
No, as I say, he did start out as a sports reporter, so, you know,
all right,
bodes well. On to the actual game show itself then. Yeah, so I picked up, I mean, Tommy Doyle, who Cardiff had brought in from Man City on loan. Cardiff had a bad result at the weekend, losing the sort of derby to Bristol City. But Tommy Doyle, the grandson of Mike Doyle and Glyn Pardoe, set up the first goal. He's been on loan in Hamburg. Great pass with the ball and his...
Sorry, the grandson of who?
Mike Doyle and Glyn Pardoe, who used to be City teammates.
Right, okay.
Yeah. City folklore, and obviously he's at Man City, so it's a nice story. But yeah, he's on loan at Cardiff, just joined, and he's quite a talented young player.
Okay, is that the end of the game show, or are you going to give us the rest?
No, there's more.
That was a really bad game show.
The generation game.
Okay.
Cameron Archer's gone on loan to Preston from Villa. He's been prolific for the 23s. Ryan Lowe's used his very good relationship with Steven Gerrard to get that one in. They came through the youth team together at Liverpool. And Ryan Lowe actually signed Archer's older brother, Jordan, when he was at Bury. So it's not the first Archer he signed. Be interesting how he does there. And the other one I just picked out was Lewis Baker, who's joined Stoke after 17 years at Chelsea. Only two first-team appearances, both as a sub in the FA Cup. Didn't make one league appearance for Chelsea in the 17 years, which he's kind of probably, when you think of all those players that Chelsea have just kind of stockpiled over the years, he's perhaps the best example of that. But yeah, now he's got a chance to impress at Stoke, and he scored at the weekend.
We've had DiMarzio Wright Phillips making us feel old, Max, and now your bullseye reference went.
Hey, no, I knew the speed of Wright reference.
Sammy got it.
Of both Ben and
anyway,
Sammy.
Anyway, so are you giving us just three out of the five, Ben? Or do you want to do all five?
We can do all five if you think we've got.
Go on, two more. Here we go. Yeah, come on. I'm enjoying this.
I would say Steve Cook to Forest is a really good signing. And likewise, after 10 years at Bournemouth, he's going to get a testimonial there. Bournemouth, you know, have decided to allow him to leave after, you know, unbelievable service. And then likewise, they brought in James Hill from Fleetwood, England under 20 defender, who was being tracked by Barcelona, of all people, back in October. Last one is Keon Etete, who's gone to Cheltenham on loan from Spurs. He had a really good first half of the season at Northampton. And I know lots of scouts were impressed with him, so I think he's got a decent future ahead.
So the game show is, much like the Generation Game, what can Barry remember? Can Barry remember those players?
Steve Cook.
Correct.
Lewis Baker.
Correct.
That's it, I'm afraid.
Well, you've won those two. Well done.
Okay.
Let's do League One, League Two. Wigan and Sunderland top of League One. Wigan got four games in hand. Looks like those two will fight it out with Rotherham and Wickham. MK Dons and Oxford in the playoffs currently. Gillingham, Doncaster. Maybe also Crewe adrift at the bottom. Morecambe also in the relegation zone. Wigan on a great run. And Sunderland have lost their consistency recently. Barry, how are you feeling?
All we want is consistency, Max. It's all we want. I don't know if this will be their year, but I'm not confident, but hopefully. I think Lee Johnson's main consistency is his lack of consistency. He's a bit of a streaky manager. He's renowned for being one, but a win against Portsmouth at the weekend, that's a good result. I'd like to know about Wigan. So they're top of the table. Couple of points clear, several games in hand, it's all looking good for them. Is this a fairy tale story of a club going from administration to promotion in jig time, or is there a more cynical view to be taken about it?
I think it's quite impressive, to be fair. I mean, they have thrown some decent money at it, but I think that's been ambition as opposed to kind of just, I don't know, reckless spending or anything near that. And it's worked. Liam Richardson has done an unbelievable job. Obviously, he was number two to Paul Cook, stuck around amid, you know, very challenging times, did amazing in the sort of in adversity really there to do what he did. And now to get them where they are, as you say, Barry, at the top, I think they've got four games in hand on some of their rivals. And they look in a really good place. And obviously, they've lost Charlie Wyke, who obviously collapsed in training. Receiving CPR first from his manager, then obviously the club doctor. We obviously continue to wish him well. I'm told that he's back among the lads and he's still going to sort of home games and some away games. I think his future is unclear, but I think it looks encouraging from what I'm told. So that's good news. And yeah, Wigan in a really good place. Like I said, they've spent some money and they've brought in players who, you know, could be in the Championship. They recently got Graham Shinney in from Derby. James McLean is more than capable of playing in the Championship. They've got a few like that, but fair play to them. It's all come together and Liam Richardson's done a really good job.
They've got a real big fixture backlog and it's interesting to see how they deal with that. Between now and the next international break, I think they've only got 1 week without a midweek fixture. So it's literally twice a week, non-stop until the end of March. They could get to the fifth round of the FA Cup because they've got Stoke in the fourth round. They've also potentially got an EFL Trophy semi-final. So I think the big thing for Wigan, they've got a decent sized squad, but it's how they can deal with that fixture backlog because that's a pretty intense run of fixtures. And I know that they're not the only side in League One or any of the EFL that are going to have to, you know, find time to play rearranged fixtures. This is actually the first EFL round since the 30th of October, by the way, that didn't have a postponed game, which I think says a lot about kind of just how many fixtures there are to organise between now and the end of the season. It's definitely going to be a factor for several sides who are just like miles behind. The league table's a mess in League One. Just like teams have played such wildly different amount of games. It's almost hard to tell like who actually is top or who actually is how far teams are in front or behind.
League Two, Dale Vince's Forest Green. Rovers have a great lead, 7 points clear with the game in hand over second place Tranmere. Sutton also in the top three, which seems incredible, Ben.
Yeah, Sutton, amazing. Matt Gray working wonders, first season in the league to be up there. And they're on a really good run to be mixing it with, you know, some decent budgets in that league and you know, big-ish teams. As you mentioned, Tranmere, who are going really well as well. I should say, esteemed commentator Nigel Adderley gave me a nudge and told me that they've conceded one league goal in 13 hours. So defensively, they're pretty sound. 40-year-old Peter Clark in the Tranmere defence. Jay Spearing of Liverpool fame in midfield. And they've just signed Kane Hemmings, who's dropped a division to join from Burton. And I think they're 10 unbeaten in the league. So going really well. As you say, Forest Green as well, Rob Edwards, another young manager doing a really good job. It's his kind of first season as a manager at senior level, and I think that's pretty impressive, to be fair. They got him out of when he was in the England system as a youth coach and worked at Wolves as well, former Wolves defender Rob Edwards. Yeah, and Forest Green are cruising, really.
I was just going to say a shout out to Mansfield, who have won seven in a row. They're up to seventh, for on a real roll in League Two, and looking like they could potentially gate crash the top of the tree in League Two. So I just thought it was worth giving Mansfield a quick dedication.
Sure. I believe the first shout out to Mansfield in Football Weekly history, unless Barry wants to correct me.
I'm honoured.
From those barren years before it got good.
I was just going to say very quickly as well, can you shoehorn in a mention for Oldham and John Sheridan's gone back for a sixth time, which has shades of Martin Allen about it. And as we were talking about earlier, Kike Sanchez Flores at Watford. So yeah, sixth time. They're bottom of League Two, got big problems. The owner has said he will sell. But yeah, they look like they could tumble into non-league.
Let's bring in Susie Rack, the Guardian's women's football correspondent. Susie, how are you doing?
Hey, Max, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. Fred the Leopard says, with Chelsea and Arsenal stumbling, City recovering, United improving, is there a real sense of a title race in the WSL this year, or is it just me?
100%. Probably for the first time, well, ever in the history of WSL, but for as long as I can remember it, at least. Yeah, it's really exciting. It's the first time where anyone can be anyone actually means something. And the interesting thing is that each week it's, for the first time, hard to pick out the best game to watch or the best game to go to, in that, you know, you look at, say, Sunday's fixtures and you've got Man City, Arsenal and Man United, Tottenham, and you think, well, they're the picks of the day. And then Chelsea take drop points at Brighton. Again, they did last season as well. Birmingham drop a 2-goal lead against Reading. And actually, you know, which game is the best is far from predictable.
I would go to the one that's nearest my house.
Probably better than doing the Manchester doubleheader
every single time. Let's talk about that City-Arsenal game. Tobin Heath equalised late on for the Gunners. But they weren't happy with Manchester City's opener. The ball hit the referee. It went on to a Man City player in the build-up. The rules state that if the ball touches a match official and remains in the field of play, a team and a team start a promising attack, play must be restarted with a drop ball. The Arsenal manager, Jonas Cederwall, said, if they're going to be on Sky Sports refereeing matches, they should be given all the resources that they need in order to prepare, practice and work on their fitness. Susie, I know rules are rules, but it wasn't like it hit the ref and City were clean through. I can see why Arsenal are annoyed, because any team would be, but they had plenty of time to get their defence in order, didn't they?
Well, I mean, technically, yes, but, you know, rules are rules. It's quite clear. It's not okay. Like the referee didn't notice the ball take a huge deflection off her leg. And if you, like, I've watched it back a few times, and I mean, Jordan Nobbs is making a run that would have intercepted that pass. And it deflects out onto the wing to Lauren Hemp, their most dangerous player, who has absolutely no one around her. Race is clear, sends in the cross. Bunny Shaw puts it in. Wasn't the best goalkeeping in the world either, but it shouldn't have ever got to that point. So I can understand the frustrations of Arsenal. It was sort of not unexpected that City would take a lead. You know, they looked more dangerous every time they broke forward. Significantly more dangerous. They always look the more likely team to score. And, you know, so in that sense, you know, it wasn't totally unjust that they went ahead. But the equaliser, I think, will be a big, big boost to Arsenal generally, because they've been really struggling to score. The five goals they've got in the sort of six games before today, four came against Leicester, who were, I think, at that point, bottom of the table, and another one was an own goal in a 4-0 defeat to Hoffenheim. So they've really struggled to find the feet.
It seems weird, because Arsenal, on paper, have got such a brilliant forward line.
Yeah, no, it really is. Something's just broken at the moment, Arsenal. They're struggling to create chances up top. Like, I can remember in the first half, there were maybe two shots. Beth Mead and Viv Miedema both sort of hit the ball from the left straight at the keeper from quite a tight angle, and that was sort of the best opportunity they were able to carve out. But it was pretty straightforward efforts, pretty straightforward saves, and they really, really struggled to find a way through. I don't know, since the Chelsea defeat in the FA Cup final, they've sort of lost their way a bit. And I think teams have followed the Chelsea blueprint and worked out how to stifle them and frustrate them.
Speaking of stifling and frustrating, Brighton did that to Chelsea. I mean, Chelsea did have so many chances in this game. You know, Frank Kirby, Eric Cuthbert, they smashed the bar. Brighton's keeper made a brilliant save. But it's interesting, you know, casual observers will just always be surprised when Chelsea don't win a football match.
Yeah, except in many respects, Brighton have become a little bit of a bogey team for Chelsea in that they did the exact same thing last season. Ended Chelsea's 33-game unbeaten run. So it's not too surprising that it's Brighton again that have delivered another blow to their title hopes. I mean, they should have won the game. They had 26 shots, 5 on target, and, you know, should have done a lot better. Brighton had lost their previous 6 games before yesterday's game as well. So, like, it's not like they are on a particularly good run of form despite having a really great start to the season. But, I mean, it's great. Emma Hayes was saying it last week that it's really, really good for the game that, you know, all of these games are unpredictable and that she's really enjoying playing them, enjoying the fact that there's, you know, half the league has female managers in it and they're really, really challenging and testing her. And Hope Powell seems to have got the better of her, you know, twice now. And it just makes that the race to the top that a little bit more interesting because they're now 4 points behind Arsenal with a game in hand. Arsenal still have to go to King's Meadow as well. And clearly now no game is a given.
And in between those two, Manchester United are second. They played a game more than Arsenal, 2 games more than Chelsea, but doing well on 24 points. What's their manager like? Every time I see Mark Skinner interviewed post-match, sort of strange, philosophical, well, I don't know why Ben's laughing, but like, I mean, it's a really open question. He might be lovely, I don't know, but sort of talks in slightly odd football speak. Is that fair?
That's definitely fair. He gives very long answers too, which isn't always the most helpful thing in the world. He's actually a really, really nice guy. I really liked him when he was at Birmingham. He did a fantastic job there. And then when he moved to the US to Orlando Pride, he got a lot of stick. He wasn't very liked. They had their worst points tally in his first season. But by the time he left, they were doing really well. They were on their best start to the season in their history. And so he sort of came in with, you know, a lot of scepticism because he wasn't that liked by the Orlando Pride fans. But I was actually really excited to see him come back to WSL because, he did wonders at Birmingham with very, very little. Now, seemingly, he started to win over fans at Man United who were not best pleased, shall we say, with the way he was handling things at the start. Problem for United, though, is their squad is so small, lacks any real depth off the bench generally at the moment, that they, you know, any injury, any more injuries, because they had Millie Turner's got some problem with an artery in her neck that's going to see her out for quite a long time by the sounds of things. And any more injuries on top of that is like could really, really derail their campaign. But it's impressive to see them doing so well. And, you know, by all accounts, Man United, the club's commitment to the team has been up and down. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they do dip into the transfer window with, you know, not many days to go to support Skinner's, like, bid for a title now. Because let's face it, they're in the title race.
All right, that's pretty much all we've got time for today. Let's leave everybody with the poetic words of Romelu Lukaku, who says, "It's no secret that Brits love a banger, and it's become one of my favourite dishes too since being in the UK. I really enjoy cooking for the people I love, and the Beyond Sausage never disappoints. Packed with 17 grams of plant-based protein, it's the perfect winter warmer and works brilliantly in hearty and wholesome dishes such as bangers and mash, toad in the hole, or it can simply be chopped up and added to pasta or used as a pizza topping. Words to live by." Thank you, Romelu.
Was that a write something like?
I'm not sure. It was just, he likes Beyond Sausage. The Beyond Sausage of Romelu Lukaku. Anyway, that'll do for today's pods. Thanks, Susie.
Cheers.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sammy.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.